Hello, this is Erica Slater, broadcasting from the Audible Local Ledger, an affiliate station of the Massachusetts Radio Reading Service. This is Backyard Bookshelf, and I will continue reading from The Storied Life of A.J. Fikry, written by Gabriella Zevin. In the last episode, we read about Ismay and Lambiez's developing relationship, and how he found the copy of Tamerlane in Ismay's closet, although he chooses not to confront her about it at that time. AJ, however, is having increasing problems, and when he visits an oncologist in Boston, he discovers that he has a brain tumour. He relays this information to Lambiez, not wishing to burden either Amelia or Maya, because he doesn't have the money for the operation. Lambiez realizes that because Ismay has the copy of Tamerlane, that perhaps selling that might be a way of AJ having his operation. When Lambiez confronts Ismay with his knowledge about the book, Ismay is very distraught and feels the need to unburden herself of Daniel, Marion Wallace, and Maya, and how a book that belonged to AJ ends up in her possession. So let's continue. The first time Marion Wallace came to see me, I was 5 months pregnant. She had Maya with her, and the baby was about 2. Marion Wallace was very young, very pretty, very tall, with tired golden brown eyes. She said, "Maya is Daniel's daughter." And I said, "And I'm not proud of this. How do I know you aren't lying?" I could see perfectly well that she wasn't lying. I knew my husband after all. I knew his type. He had cheated on me from the day we were married, and probably before that too. But I loved his books, or at least that first one, and I felt like somewhere deep inside him the person who wrote it must be there. That you couldn't write such beautiful things and have such an ugly heart. But that is the truth. He was a beautiful writer and a terrible person. I can't blame Daniel for all of this, though. I can't blame him for my part in it. I screamed at Marion Wallace. She was 22, but she looked like a kid. "Do you think you're the first slut to show up here claiming to have had Daniel's baby?" She apologized, kept apologizing. She said, "The baby doesn't have to be in Daniel Parrish's life." She kept calling him by his first and last name. She was a fan, you see. She respected him. "The baby doesn't have to be in Daniel Parrish's life. We won't bother you ever again, I swear to God. We just need a little money to get started, to move on. He said he would help, and now I can't find him anywhere." Ah, this made sense to me. Daniel was always travelling a lot, visiting writer at a school in Switzerland, trips to Los Angeles that never resulted in anything. "Okay," I said, "I'll try and get in contact with him and see what I can do. If he acknowledges that your story is true..." But I already knew it was, Lambiez. "If he acknowledges that your story is true, maybe we can do something." The girl wanted to know how she could best contact me. I told her I'd be in touch. I talked to Daniel that night on the phone. It was a good talk, and I didn't bring up Marion Wallace. He was solicitous of me, started making plans for our own baby's arrival. "Ismay," he said, "once the baby's here, I'm going to be a changed man." I'd heard that before. "No, I'm serious," he insisted. "I'm definitely going to travel less. I'm going to stay at home, write more, take care of you and the potato." He was always a good talker, and I wanted to believe that this was the night everything was going to change in my marriage. I decided right then and there that I would take care of the problem with Marion Wallace. I would find a way to buy her off. People in this town have always thought my family had more money than we actually did. Nick and I did have small trust funds. It wasn't a ton. She used hers to buy the store, and I used mine to buy this house. What was left over from my side my husband spent quickly. His first book sold well, but the ones after that less so, and he always had champagne tastes and inconsistent income. I'm only a schoolteacher. Daniel and I always looked rich, but we were poor. Down the hill, my sister had been dead for over a year, and her husband was steadily drinking himself to death. Out of obligation to her, I would check on AJ some nights. I'd let myself in, wipe the vomit off his face, and drag him to bed. One night I go in, AJ is passed out as usual, and Tamerlane is sitting on the table. I should say here that I was with him the day he found Tamerlane. Not that he ever to split the money with me, which probably would have been the decent thing to do. Cheap bastard would never have been at that estate sale if it wasn't for me. So I put AJ to bed and I go out to the living room to clean up the mess, and I wipe everything down, and the last thing I do without even really thinking about it, I slip the book into my bag. The next day everyone is looking for Tamerlane, but I'm out of town. I've gone to Cambridge for the day. I go to Marion Wallace's dorm room, and I throw the book on her bed. I tell her, "Look, you can sell this. It's worth a lot of money." And she looks at the book dubiously, and she says, "Is it hot?" And I say, "No, it belongs to Daniel, and he wants you to have it, but you can never say where it came from. Bring it to an auction house or a rare books dealer. Claim you found it in the used book bin somewhere." I don't hear from Marion Wallace again for a while, and I think maybe that's the end of it. Ismay's voice trails off. "But it isn't?" Lambiez asks. "No. She shows up at the house with Maya and the book just before Christmas. She says she's gone to every auction house and dealer in the Boston area, and none of them want to deal with the book because it doesn't have a provenance, and the cops have been calling about a stolen copy of Tamerlane. She takes the book from her bag and hands it to me. I throw it back at her. What am I going to do with this?" Marion Wallace just shakes her head. The book lands on the floor and the little girl picks it up and starts flipping through it, but no one's paying any attention to her. Marion Wallace's huge amber eyes filled with tears, and she says, "Have you read Tamerlane, Mrs. Parrish? It's so sad." I shake my head. "It's a poem about this Turkish conqueror who trades the love of his life, this poor peasant girl, for power." I roll my eyes at her and I say, "Is that what you think is happening here? Do you fancy yourself some poor peasant girl and I'm the mean wife who is keeping you from the love of your life?" "No," she says. At this point the baby is crying. Marion says that the worst of it is that she knew what she was doing. Daniel had come to her college for a reading and she had loved that book. And when she slept with him, she had read his autobiography a million times, and she knew perfectly well that he was married. "I've made so many mistakes," she says. "I can't help you," I say, and she shakes her head and picks up the baby. "Well, we'll be out of your way now," she says. "Merry Christmas." And they leave. And I'm pretty shaken up, so I go to the kitchen to make myself some tea, and when I get back to the living room, I notice that the little girl has left her backpack, and Tamerlane is on the floor next to it. I pick up the book. I'm thinking I'll just slip it into AJ's apartment tomorrow or the next night and return it. But then I notice that it's covered in crayon drawings. The little girl has ruined it. I zip it into the bag and put it in my closet, and I don't take pains to hide it very much. I think maybe Daniel will find it and ask me about it, but he never does. He never cares. That night, AJ calls me about the proper things to feed a baby. He's got Maya at his apartment, and I agree to go over. The day after that, Marion Wallace is up by the lighthouse, Lambier said. Yes. I wait to see if Daniel will say anything, to see if he will recognize the girl and claim the baby, but he doesn't. And I, coward that I am, never bring it up. Lambier takes her in his arms. None of this matters, he says after a while. If there was a crime... There was a crime, she insists. If there was a crime, he repeats, everyone who knows about any of this is dead. Except Maya. Maya's life has turned out beautifully, Lambier says. Ismay shakes her head. It has, hasn't it? The way I see it, Lambier said, you saved A.J. Fikri's life when you stole that manuscript. That's the way I see it. What kind of cop are you? Ismay asks. The old kind, he says. The next night, like every third Wednesday of every month of the last 10 years, is Chief's Choice at Island Books. At first, the police officers felt obligated to join, but the group has grown in genuine popularity over the years. Now it's the largest book meet-up that the island has. Police officers still make up the bulk of membership, but their wives and even some of their children, when they get old enough, attend too. Years ago, Lambier's had to institute a leave-your-weapons policy after a young cop had pulled a gun on another cop during a particularly heated discussion of the House of Sand and Fog. Lambier's would later reflect to AJ that the selection had been a mistake. Had an interesting cop character, but too much moral ambiguity in that one. I'm going to stick to easier genre stuff from now on. Other than this incident, the group had been free of violence, aside from the contents of the books, of course. As is his tradition, Lambier's arrives at the store early to set up for Chief's Choice and to talk to AJ. I saw this resting on the door, Lambier says when he comes inside. He hands a padded manila envelope with AJ's name on it to his friend. Probably another galley, AJ says. Oh, don't say that, Lambier's jokes. Could be the next big thing in there. Yeah, I'm sure it's probably the great American novel. I'll add it to my stack. Things to read before brain stops working. AJ sets the package on the countertop and Lambier's watches it. Well, you never know, Lambier says. I'm like a girl who's been on the dating scene too long. I've had too many disappointments, too many promises of the one, and they never are. As a cop, don't you get that way? What way? Cynical, I guess, AJ says. Don't you ever get to the point where you expect the worst from people all the time? Lambier shakes his head. No, I see good people just as much as I see bad ones. Yeah, name me some. People like you, my friend. Lambier clears his throat and AJ can think of no reply. What's good in crime that I haven't read? I need some new picks for Chief's Choice. AJ walks over to the crime section. He looks across the spines, which are for the most part black and red and with all capitalized fonts in silvers and whites. An occasional burst of fluorescence breaks up the monotony. AJ thinks how similar everything in the crime genre looks. Why is any one book different from any other book? They are different, AJ decides, because they are. We have to look inside many. We have to believe. We agree to be disappointed sometimes so that we can be exhilarated every now and again. He selects one and holds it out to his friend. Maybe this? What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, 1980, Raymond Carver. Two couples get increasingly drunk, discuss what is and what is not love. A question I thought about a great deal is why is it so much easier to write about the things we dislike, hate, acknowledge to be flawed, than the things that we love? This is my favourite story, Maya, and I cannot yet begin to tell you why. You and Amelia are my favourite people, too. AJF. This accounts for much of the internet, of course. Lot 2200. A last-minute addition to the afternoon's auction and a rare opportunity for the vintage book connoisseur, Tamerlane and Other Poems by Edgar Allan Poe, written when Poe was 18 and attributed to a Bostonian. Only 50 printed at the time. Tamerlane will be the crown jewel in any serious rare books collection. This copy shows some wear at the spine and is marked in crayon on the cover. The damage should not in any way spoil the beauty or diminish the rarity of this object, which cannot be overstated. Let the bidding begin at $20,000. The book sells for $72,000, modestly exceeding the reserve. After fees and taxes, this is enough money to cover AJ's copay on the surgery and the first round of radiation. Even after he receives the check from Christie's, AJ has doubts about whether to go through with treatment. He still suspects that the money will be better spent on Maya's college education. "No," Maya says, "I'm smart. I'll get a scholarship. I'll write the world's saddest admissions essay about how I was an orphan abandoned in a bookstore by my single mother and how my adopted father got the rarest form of brain cancer. But look at me now. An upstanding member of society. People will eat it up, Dad." "That's awfully crass of you, my little nerd," AJ laughs at the monster he has created. "I have money too," the wife insists. Bottom line is, the women in AJ's life want him to live, so he books the surgery. Sitting here, I find myself thinking that the late bloomer really was a bunch of hokum, Amelia says bitterly. She stands up and walks over to the window. "Do you want the blinds raised or lowered?" "Raised, we get a spot of natural light and a lovely view of the children's hospital across the way. Lowered, you can enjoy my deathly pallor under the fluorescent lights. It's up to you." "Raised," AJ says. "I want to remember you at your best." "Do you remember when Friedman writes how you can't truly describe a hospital room? How a hospital room, when the one you love is in it, is too painful to be described, or some such crap? How did we ever think that that was poetic? I'm disgusted with it. At this stage in my life, I'm with all the people that never wanted to read that book in the first place. I'm with the cover designer who put flowers and the feet on the front, because you know what? You totally can describe a hospital room. It's grey. The art is the worst art you've ever seen. Like stuff they got rejected by the Holiday Inn or something. Everything smells like someone is trying to cover up the smell of pee." "You love the late bloomer, Amy." She has still never told him about Leon Friedman. "But I didn't want to be in some stupid play version of it when I was in my 40s. Do you think I should really have this surgery?" Amelia rolls her eyes. "Yes, I do. Number one, it's happening in 20 minutes, so we probably couldn't get our money back anyway. And number two, you've had your head shaved and you look like a terrorist. I don't see what the point is in turning back now," Amelia says. "Is it really worth the money for 2 more years that are likely to be crappy?" he asks Amelia. "It is," she says, taking his hand. "I remember a woman who told me about the importance of shared sensibilities. I remember a woman who said she broke up with a bona fide American hero because they didn't have good conversation." "That could happen to us, you know," AJ says. "That's an entirely different situation," Amelia insists. A second later, she yells, "Damn it!" AJ thinks something must be seriously wrong, because Amelia never curses. "What is it?" "Well, the thing is, I rather like your brain." He laughs at her and she weeps a little. "Oh, enough with the tears. I don't want your pity. I'm not crying for you. I'm crying for me. Do you know how long it took me to find you? Do you know how many awful dates I've been on? I can't, and she's breathless now, I can't join Match.com again. I just can't. Big Bird, always looking ahead. Big Bird, what the? You can't introduce a nickname at this point in our relationship. You'll meet someone. I did. Damn you. I like you and I'm used to you. You are the one, you asshole. I can't meet someone new. He kisses her, and then she reaches under his hospital gown between his legs and squeezes. I love having sex with you, she says. If you're a vegetable when this is all done, can I still have sex with you? She asks. Sure, AJ says. And you won't think less of me? No. He pauses. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the turn this conversation has taken, he says. You knew me 4 years before you asked me out. True. You were so mean to me the day we met. Also true. I'm so screwed up. How will I ever find someone else? You seem remarkably unconcerned about my brain. Your brain's toast. We both know that. But what about me? Poor Amy. Yes, before I was a bookseller's wife, that was pitiable enough. Soon I'll be the bookseller's widow. She kisses him on every place of his malfunctioning head. I liked this brain. I like this brain. It's a very good brain. Me too, he says. The attendant comes to wheel him away. I love you, she says with a resigned shrug. I want to leave you with something cleverer than that, but it's all I know. When he wakes, he finds the words are more or less there. It takes a while to find some of them, but they are there. Blood, painkiller, vomit, buckets, hemorrhoids, diarrhea, water, blisters, diaper, ice. After surgery, he is brought to an isolated wing of the hospital for a month-long course of radiation. His immune system is so compromised from the radiation that he isn't allowed any visitors. It is the loneliest he has ever been, and that includes the period after Nick's death. He wishes he could get drunk, but this irradiated stomach couldn't take it. This is what life had been like before Maya and before Amelia. A man is not his own island. Or at least a man is not optimally his own island. When he isn't throwing up or restlessly half-sleeping, he digs out the e-reader his mother had given him last Christmas. The nurses deem the e-reader to be more sanitary than a paper book. They should put that on the box, AJ quips. He finds that he can't stay awake to read an entire novel. Short stories are better. He's always preferred short stories anyway. As he is reading, he finds that he wants to make a new list of short stories for Maya. She is going to be a writer, he knows. He is not a writer, but he has thoughts about the profession, and he wants to tell her those things. Maya, novels certainly have their charms, but the most elegant creation in the prose universe is a short story. Master the short story and you will have mastered the world, he thinks before he drifts off to sleep. I should write this down, he thinks. He reaches for a pen, but there isn't one anywhere near the toilet bowl he is resting against. At the end of the radiation treatment, the oncologist finds that his tumour has neither shrunk nor grown. He gives AJ a year. Your speech and everything else will likely deteriorate, he says in a voice that strikes AJ as incongruously chipper. No matter, AJ is glad to be going home. The Bookseller, 1986, Roald Dahl. Bonbon about a bookseller with an unusual way of extorting money from customers. In terms of characters, it is Dahl's usual collection of opportunistic grotesques. In terms of plot, the twist is a latecomer and not enough to redeem the story's flaws. The bookseller really shouldn't be on this list. It is not an exceptional dull offering in any way. Certainly no lamb to the slaughter, and yet here it is. How to account for its presence when I know it is only average? The answer is this. Your dad relates to the characters. It has meaning to me. And the longer I do this, bookselling, yes, of course, is also a living that isn't too awfully sentimental, the more I believe that this is what the point of it all is. To connect my dear little nerd. Only connect. AJF. It is so simple, he thinks. Maya, he wants to say, I have figured it all out. But his brain won't let him. The words you can't find, you borrow. We read to know we're not alone. We read because we are alone. We read and we are not alone. We are not alone. My life is in these books, he wants to tell her. Read these and know my heart. We are not quite novels. The analogy he is looking for is almost there. We are not quite short stories. At this point, his life is seeming closest to that. In the end, we are collected works. He has read enough to know that there are no collections where each story is perfect. Some hits, some misses. If you're lucky, a standout, and in the end, people only really remember the standouts anyway, and they don't remember those for very long. No, not very long. Dad, Maya says. He tries to figure out what she's saying. The lips and the sound, what can they mean? Thankfully, she repeats. Dad. Yes, Dad. Dad is what I am. Dad is what I became, the father of Maya. Maya's dad. Dad. What a word, what a little big word. What a word and what a world. He is crying. His heart is too full and no words to release it. I know what words do, he thinks. They let us feel less. No, Dad, please don't. It's okay. She puts her arms around him. Reading has become difficult. If he tries very hard, he can still make it through a short story. Novels have become impossible. He can write more easily than he can speak, not that writing is easy. He writes a paragraph a day. A paragraph for Maya. It isn't much, but it's what he has left to give. He wants to tell her something very important. Does it hurt? She asks. No, he thinks. The brain has no pain sensors, and so it can't hurt. The loss of his mind has turned out to be a curiously pain-free process. He feels that it ought to hurt more. Are you afraid? She asks. Not of dying, he thinks. But a little of this part I'm in. Every day there is less of me. Today I am thoughts without words. Tomorrow I will be a body without thoughts, and so it goes. But Maya, you are here right now, and I am so glad to be here. Even without books and words, even without my mind. How the hell do you say this? How do you even begin? Maya is staring at him, and now she is crying too. Maya, he says. There's only one word that matters. He looks at her to see if she has been understood. Her brow is furrowed, and he can tell that he hasn't made himself clear. Damn! Most of what he says is gibberish these days. If he wants to be understood, it is best to limit himself to one-word replies. but some things take longer than one word to explain. He will try again. He will never stop trying. Maya, we are what we love. We are what we love. Maya is shaking her head. Dad, I'm sorry, I don't understand. We aren't the things we collect, acquire, read. We are, for as long as we are here, only love. The things we loved. The people we loved. And these, I think, these really do live on. She is still shaking her head. I can't understand you, Dad. I wish I could. Do you want me to get Amy? Or maybe you could try to type it. He is sweating. Conversing isn't fun anymore. It used to be so easy. All right, he thinks. If it's got to be one word, it's got to be one word. Love, he asks. He prays it has come out right. She furrows her brow and tries to read his face. Gloves? She asks. Are your hands cold, Dad? He nods, and she takes his hand in hers. His hands had been cold, and now they are warm, and he decides that he's gotten close enough for today. Tomorrow, maybe he'll find the final words. At the bookseller's funeral, the question on everyone's mind is, what will become of Island Books? People are attached to their bookstores, more attached than A.J. Ever Fikry would have ever guessed. It matters who placed A Wrinkle in Time in your 12-year-old daughter's nail-bitten fingers, or who sold you Let's Go Travel Guide to Hawaii, or who insisted that your aunt, with the very particular tastes, would surely adore Cloud Atlas. Furthermore, they like Island Books, and even though they aren't always perfectly faithful, even though they buy e-books sometimes and shop online, they like what it says about their town, that Island Books is right in the center of the main strip, that it is the second or third place you come after you get off the ferry. At the funeral, they approach Maya and Amelia, respectfully, of course, and whisper, AJ can't ever be replaced. But will you find someone else to run the store? Amelia doesn't know what to do. She loves Alice. She loves Island Books. She has no experience running a bookstore. She's always worked on the publisher side of things, and she needs her steady paycheck and health insurance even more now that she is responsible for Maya. She considers leaving the store open and letting someone else run it during the week, but the plan isn't tenable. The commute is too great, and what it really makes sense to do is to move off the island altogether. After a week of heart sickness and bad sleep and intellectual pacing, she decides to close the store. The store, the building the store is housed in and the land it sits on, at least, is worth a lot of money. Nick and AJ had bought it outright all those years ago. Amelia loves Island Books, but she can't make it work. For a month or so, she makes attempts at selling the store, but no buyers come forward. She puts the building on the market. Island Books will close at the end of summer. End of an era, Lambier says to Ismay over eggs at the local diner. He's broken-hearted over the news, but he's planning to leave Alice soon anyway. He will have 25 years on the police force next spring, and he's got a fair amount of money saved up. He imagines himself buying a boat and living on the Florida Keys, like a retired cop character in an Elmore Leonard novel. He's been trying to convince Ismay to come with him, and he thinks he's starting to wear her down. Lately, she's been finding fewer and fewer reasons to object, although she is one of those odd New England creatures who actually likes the winter. I hoped they'd find someone else to run the store, but the truth is, Island Books wouldn't be the same without A.J. Meyer and Amelia anyway, Lambier says. Wouldn't have the same heart. True, Ismay says. It's gross, though. They'll probably turn it into a Forever 21. What's a Forever 21? Ismay laughs at him. How do you not know this? Wasn't it ever referenced in one of those young adult novels you were always reading? Young adult fiction isn't like that. It's a chain clothing store. Actually, we should be so lucky, they'll probably turn it into a bank. She sips her coffee. Or a drugstore. Oh, maybe a Jamba Juice, Liamba says. I love Jamba Juice. Ismay starts to cry. The waitress stops by the table and Lambier's indicates that she should clear the plates. I know how you feel, Lambier says. I don't like it either, Izzy. You know something funny about me? I never read much before I met AJ and started going to Ireland. As a kid, the teachers thought I was a slow reader, so I never got the knack for it. You tell a kid he doesn't like to read and he'll believe you, Ismay says. Mainly got C's in English, too. Once AJ adopted Maya, I wanted to have an excuse to go into the store and check on them, so I kept reading whatever he'd give me, and then I started to like it. Ismay cries harder. Turns out I really like bookstores. You know, I meet a lot of people in my line of work. A lot of folks pass through Alice Island, especially in the summer. I've seen movie people on vacation, and I've seen music people and news people too. There ain't nobody in the world like book people. It's a business of gentleman and gentlewoman. I wouldn't go that far, Ismay says. I don't know, Izzy. I'm telling you, bookstores attract the right kind of folk, good people like AJ and Amelia. And I like talking about books with people who like talking about books. I like paper. I like how it feels. And I like the feel of a book in my back pocket. I like how a new book smells, too. Ismay kisses him. You're the funniest sort of cop I ever met. I worry about what Alice is going to be like if there isn't a bookstore here, Lambier says as he finishes his coffee. Me too. Lambier leans across the table and kisses her on the cheek. Hey, here's a crazy thought. What if instead of going to Florida, you and me took over the place? In this economy, this is a crazy thought, Ismay says. Yeah. Probably so. The waitress asks if they want dessert. Ismay says she doesn't want anything, but Lambier knows she'll always share a little of his. He orders a slice of cherry pie and two forks. But you know, what if we did? Lambier continues. I've got savings and I've got a pretty good pension about to come in, and so do you. And AJ said the summer people always bought a lot of books. The summer people have e-readers now, Ismay counters. True, Lambier says. He decides to let the subject drop. They were halfway through their pie when Ismay says, We could open a cafe too. That would probably help with the bottom line. Yeah, AJ used to talk about that sometimes. And, Ismay says, we turn the basement into a theatre space. That way, the author events don't have to be right in the middle of the store. Maybe people could even rent it as a theatre or a meeting space sometimes too. Your theatre background would be great for that, Lambier says. Are you sure you're up to this? We aren't super young, Ismay says. What about no winters? What about Florida? We'll go there when we're old. We're not old yet, Lambier says after a pause. I've lived in Alice my whole life. It's the only place I've ever known. It's a nice place, and I intend to keep it that way. A place ain't a place without a bookstore, Izzy. A few years after she sells the store to Ismay and Lambier's, Amelia decides to leave Knightley Press. Maya is graduating from high school soon, and Amelia is tired of traveling so much. She finds a position as a book buyer for a large general retailer out of Maine. Before she leaves, as her predecessor Harvey Rhodes had done, Amelia writes up notes on all her active accounts. She saves Island Books for last. Island Books, she reports, owners Ismay Parrish, ex-school teacher, and Nicholas Lambiers, ex-police chief. Lambiers is an exceptional hand seller, especially of literary crime fiction and young adult novels. Parrish, who used to run the high school drama club, can be counted on to throw out an A-plus author event. The store has a cafe, a stage, and an excellent online presence. All this was built on the solid foundation established by A.J. Fickrey, the original owner, whose tastes ran more towards the literary. The store still carries a ton of literary fiction, but the owners won't take what they can't sell. I love Island Books with all my heart. I do not believe in God, I have no religion, but this to me is as close to a church as I have known in this life. It is a holy place. With bookstores like this, I feel confident in saying that there will be a book business for a very long time. Amelia Lohman. Amelia feels a bit embarrassed about those last sentences and cuts out everything after the owners won't take what they can't sell. The owners won't take what they can't sell. Jacob Gardner reads his predecessor's notes one last time and then clicks off his phone and disembarks the ferry with long, purposeful strides. Jacob, 27 years old and armed with a half-paid-off master's degree in non-fiction writing, is ready. He can't believe his luck in landing this job. Sure, the pay could be better, but he loves books. He's always loved books. He believes that books saved his life. He even has that famous C.S. Lewis quote tattooed on his wrist. Imagine getting to be one of those people who actually gets paid to talk about literature. He'd do this for free. Not that he wants his publisher to know that. He needs the money. Living in Boston isn't cheap, and he's only doing this day job to support his passion, his oral history of gay vaudevillians. But this isn't to take away from the fact that Jacob Gardner is nothing short of a believer. He even walks like he has a calling. He could be mistaken for a missionary. In point of fact, he was raised Mormon, but that is another story. Island is Jacob's first sale call, and he can't wait to get there. He can't wait to tell them about all the great books he's carrying in his nightly press tote bag. The bag must weigh 50 pounds, but Jacob works out and he isn't even feeling it. Knightley's got a remarkably strong list this year, and he's certain his job will be easy. Readers are going to have no choice but to love these titles. The nice woman who hired him had suggested that he starts with Island Books. The owner there loves literary crime fiction, eh? Well, Jacob's favourite from the list is a debut about an Amish girl who disappears while on Rumspringer. And in Jacob's opinion, it's a must-read for all serious lovers of literary crime fiction. As Jacob passes over the threshold of the Purple Victorian, the wind chimes play their familiar song, and a gruff but not unfriendly voice calls, "Welcome!" Jacob walks down the history aisle and holds out his hand to the middle-aged man on the ladder. "Mr. Lambiers, have I got a book for you?" And that concludes The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed reading it. So we have a few minutes left of the hour that we're here together. And I thought I'd start a new book that I will be continuing to read over the next coming weeks. And it's a book by Bill Bryson, who is actually a very funny writer. And he lived in the UK for a number of years, about 20 years altogether. And he wrote this book upon returning to America. It's called A Walk in the Woods, Rediscovering America on the Appalachian Trail. This book describes the author's experiences whilst walking the Appalachian Trail and reflects his opinion relating to those experiences. Some names and identifying details of individuals mentioned in this book have been changed to protect their privacy. Chapter 1. Not long after I moved with my family to a small town in New Hampshire, I happened upon a path that vanished into a wood on the edge of town. A sign announced that this was no ordinary footpath, but the celebrated Appalachian Trail, running more than 2,100 miles along America's eastern seaboard, through the serene and beckoning Appalachian Mountains. The AT is the granddaddy of long hikes. From Georgia to Maine, it wanders across 14 states, through plump, comely hills whose very names, Blue Ridge, Smokies, Cumberlands, Green Mountains, White Mountains, seem an invitation to amble. Who could say the words Great Smoky Mountains or Shenandoah Valley and not feel an urge, as the naturalist John Muir once put it, to throw a loaf of bread and a pound of tea in an old sack and jump over the back fence? And here it was, quite unexpectedly, meandering in a dangerously beguiling fashion through the pleasant New England community in which I had just settled. It seemed such an extraordinary notion that I could set off from home and walk 1,800 miles through woods to Georgia, or turn the other way and clamber over the rough and stony White Mountains to the fabled prow of Mount Katahdin, floating in a forest 450 miles to the north in a wilderness few have seen. A little voice in my head said, "Sounds neat, let's do it." I formed a number of rationalizations. It would get me fit after years of waddlesome sloth. It would be an interesting and reflective way to reacquaint myself with the scale and the beauty of my native land after nearly 20 years of living abroad. It would be useful, I wasn't quite sure in what way, but I was sure nonetheless, to learn to fend for myself in the wilderness. When guys in camouflage pants and hunting hats sat around the Four Aces diner talking about fearsome things done out of doors, I would no longer have to feel like such a cupcake. I wanted a little of that swagger that comes from being able to gaze at a far horizon through the eyes of chipped granite and say with a slow, manly sniff, "Yep, I've crept in the woods." And there was a more compelling reason to go. The Appalachians are the home of one of the greatest hardwood forests, the expansive relic of the richest, most diversified sweep of woodland ever to grace the temperate world. And that forest is in trouble. If the global temperature rises by 4 degrees centigrade over the next 50 years, as is evidently possible, the whole of the Appalachian wilderness below New England could become savanna. Already trees are dying in frightening numbers. The elms and the chestnuts are long gone. The stately hemlocks and the flowery dogwoods are going, and the red spruces, Fraser firs, mountain ashes and sugar maples may be about to follow. Clearly, if there was ever a time to experience this singular wilderness, it was now. So I decided to do it. More rashly, I announced my intention, told friends and neighbours, confidently informed my publisher, made it common knowledge among those who knew me. Then I bought some books and talked to people who had done the trail in whole or in part, and came gradually to realize that this was way beyond anything I had attempted before. Nearly everyone I talked to had some gruesome stories involving a guileless acquaintance who had gone off hiking the trail with high hopes and new boots and come back stumbling 2 days later with a bobcat attached to his head, or dripping blood from an armless sleeve and whispering in a hoarse voice, "Bear, bear," before sinking into a troubled unconsciousness. The woods were full of peril. Rattlesnakes and water moccasins, and nests of copperheads, bobcats, bears, coyotes, wolves, and wild boar, loony hillbillies destabilized by gross quantities of impure corn liquor, and generations of profoundly unbiblical sex, rabies-crazed skunks, raccoons and squirrels, merciless fire ants, and ravening blackfly, poison ivy, poison sumac, poison oak, and poison salamanders, even a scattering of moose lethally deranged by a parasitic worm that burrows a nest in their brains and befuddles them into chasing hapless hikers through a remote sunny meadows and into glacial lakes. Literally, unimaginable things could happen to you out there. I heard of a man who had stepped from his tent for a midnight pee and was swooped upon by a short-sighted hoot owl. The last he saw of his scalp, it was dangling from the talons, prettily silhouetted against the harvest moon. And of a young woman who was woken by a tickle across her belly and peered into her sleeping bag to find a copperhead bunking down in the warmth between her legs. I heard four separate stories, always related with a chuckle, of campers and bears sharing tents for a few confused and lively moments. Stories of people abruptly vaporized, t'were nothing left of them but a scorch mark, by body-sized bolts of lightning when caught in sudden storms on high ridgelines, of tents crushed beneath falling trees, or eased off precipices, on ball bearings of beaded rain and sent paragliding on into the distant valley doors, or swept away on the watery wall of flash flood, of hikers beyond counting whose last experience was trembling earth and the befuddled thought, "Now what?" And it only required a little light reading in adventure books and almost no imagination to envision circumstances in which I would find myself caught in a tightening circle of hunger-emboldened wolves, staggering and shredding clothes under an onslaught of pincered fire ants, or dumbly transfixed by the sight of enlivened undergrowth advancing towards me like a torpedo through water before being bowled backwards by a sofa-sized boar with cold, beady eyes, a piercing squill and a slaverous chomping appetite for pink, plump, sooty-softened flesh. Then there are all the diseases one is vulnerable to in the woods. Giardiasis, Eastern equine encephalitis, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, Lyme disease, ehrlichiosis, schistosomiasis, brucellosis, shigellosis, to offer but a sampling. Eastern equine encephalitis, caused by a prick of a mosquito, attacks the brain and the central nervous system. If you're lucky, you can hope to spend the rest of your life propped in a chair with a bib around your neck, but generally it will kill you. There is no known cure. No arresting is Lyme disease, which comes from a bite from a tiny deer tick. If undetected, it can lie dormant in the human body for years before erupting in a positive fiesta of maladies. This is a disease for the person who wants to experience it all. The symptoms include, but are not limited to, headaches, fatigue, fever, chills, shortness of breath, dizziness, shooting pains in the extremities, cardiac irregularities, facial paralysis, muscle spasms, severe mental impairment, loss of control of body functions, and, hardly surprising really, chronic depression. Then there is the little-known family of organisms called hantaviruses, which swarm in the microhaze above the feces of mice and rats, and are hoovered into the human respiratory system by anyone lucky enough to stick a breathing orifice near them, by laying down, say, on a sleeping platform over which infected mice have recently scampered. In 1993, a single outbreak of hantavirus killed 32 people in the southwestern United States, and the following year, the disease claimed its first victim on the AT when a hiker contracted it after sleeping in a rodent-infested shelter. All AT shelters are rodent-infested. Among viruses, only rabies, Ebola, and HIV are most certainly lethal. Again, there is no treatment. Finally, this being America, there is the constant possibility of murder. At least 9 hikers, the actual number depends on which source you consult and how you define a hiker, have been murdered along the trail since 1974. 2 young women would die whilst I was out there. For various practical reasons, principally to do with the long, punishing winters of northern New England, there are only so many available months to hike the trail each year. If you start at the northern end, at Mount Katahdin in Maine, you must wait for the snows to clear in late May or June. If, on the other hand, you start in Georgia and head north, you must take time to finish it before mid-October, when the snows blow back in. Most people hike from south to north with the spring, ideally keeping one step ahead of the worst of the hot weather and the more irksome and infectious insects. My intention was to start in the south in early March, and I put aside 6 weeks for the first leg. The precise length of the Appalachian Trail is a matter of interesting uncertainty. The U.S. National Park Service, which constantly distinguishes itself in a variety of ways, manages in a single leaflet to give the length of the trail as 2,155 miles and 2,200 miles. The official Appalachian Trail Guides, a set of 11 books, each dealing with a particular state or section, variously gives the length as 2,144 miles, 2,147 miles, 2,159 miles, and more than 2,150 miles. The Appalachian Trail Conference, the governing body, in 1993 put the trail length at exactly 2,146.7 miles, then changed for a couple of years to a hesitatingly vague more than 2,150 miles, but has recently returned to a confident precision with a length of 2,160.2 miles. In 1993, 3 people rolled a measuring wheel along its entire length and came up with a distance of 2,164.9 miles. At about the same time, a careful measure based on a full set of U.S. Geographical Survey maps put the distance at 2,118.3 miles. What is certain is that it's a long way from either end, and it is not easy. The peaks of the Appalachian Trail are not particularly formidable as mountains go. The highest, the Clingman's Dome in Tennessee, tops out at a little under 6,700 feet, but they are big enough and they go on and on. And there are more than 350 peaks over 5,000 feet along the AT, and perhaps 1,000 more in the vicinity. And that's all we have time for today. This has been Erica Slater, reading for Backyard Bookshelf. I'd like to remind you of our telephone number, 508 1-800-539-2030. Please call us with your comments, suggestions, and questions. I thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day, and I look forward to being with you next week.